Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to this latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. We're taking a short break at the moment, so we thought we'd look back into the archives and pick out some of our great material that many of you have never heard. Today, we go back to talk to Tony Blackman about the V-bombers and his test pilot experiences. Enjoy the episode.
Hello and welcome to Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Former Avro chief test pilot and aviation officer Tony Blackman. When you see a photo of someone sat next to Captain Winkle Brown and Neil Armstrong, you know you have a very special guest on the show tonight. Tony, welcome to Extended again.
Thank you.
You've had a pretty amazing career being involved with test flying all three V-bombers and the Nimrod, as well as with Smith Industries and then with the CAA, as well as branching out into driving aviation, non-fiction and fiction. Let's go back to the beginning. I mean, what inspired you to fly in the first place? I believe you were quite unusual in that maths rather than flying was your way into the RAF.
Well, it was pure luck, really. I've been very lucky in all my career. It was pure luck. I was called up to do my national service. And I was teaching maths and physics, but it so happened that they were student pilots and navigators. And having done that for a year or so, they asked me to join one of the courses and learn to fly, and I couldn't resist it.
Brilliant. You joined the RAF, and then you flew Vampires and Venoms in Germany. So what was that like, being on the tip of the spear in the Cold War?
Well, yes, I suppose I should have been more conscious, but I wasn't more conscious. We weren't all that conscious. I wasn't of the Cold War. It was, of course, a wonderful time there, flying the aircraft, and we had all the correct training, and we used to go off and do all the gun firing up North Germany. It was a very interesting time, and of course, the aircraft were being developed all the time. We started on Vampires, we went to Venoms. And the Hunters were just about coming along as I was leaving.
Was there much kind of low-level flying? I hear stories, I read about stories about, people kind of flying under bridges and all that kind of stuff.
I don't remember too much about the low-level stuff. I remember all the high-level stuff we used to do. We certainly, in our squadrons, it was mostly high-level, and we didn't do a lot of low-level stuff at all.
So you then trained as a test pilot and went on to join AV Row at the time. So that must have been a particularly exciting time to join the company.
Well, it was. I was, again, fortunate. I was on the acceptance team for the first RAF Vulcan Mark I. And so Alvin the Avro got to know me. And I don't know whether you remember, but at the time there was a project, the 730 Mach 3 bomber, which was specified, and Avro's won the competition for it, and they wanted a project pilot to see it right through from beginning to end, and so that's why they recruited me. But of course, shortly after I joined Avro's, the Avro 730 was cancelled, but of course we had lots of work on, very luckily. We had the Mark II Vulcan coming along.
And the Avro 730, that would have been the kind of the British version of the SR-71, presumably.
Oh, it was amazing aircraft. It was amazing, I think. And it was a television that there was no transparency for the pilot to look out. It was going to be a TV. It was going to be TV cameras, and we'd have to fly it through the TV.
Wow. As chief test pilot, then you then went on to help develop the Vulcan, the Nimrod, the Victor tanker, and the Avro 748. Which was your favourite out of all of these, and why?
Well, of course, the Vulcan was a splendid aircraft to fly. I mean, with a stick, and the way the aircraft handled, it was magnificent. And just landing the Vulcan was always a delight. It was superb. So I used to like, in fact, I was very lucky enough. I flew the Concorde once on a test flight. And again, it was absolutely a great thing, you know, a great experience. But on the other, of the aircraft that... The 748 was a very interesting aircraft. It was a workhorse. It wasn't a delight to fly in a way, but it was earning its keep.
Yeah.
It was a very interesting aircraft.
Now, obviously, in those days, a test pilot's work could be pretty dangerous. Have you any incidents that stick out in your mind where you think, phew, I'm lucky I got away with that?
Well, no, I think I've been very lucky. Of course, test flying is all about minimizing risk, and very fortunate I didn't really have any incident at all. I was very lucky. My predecessor had a complete electrical failure, and he got the crew out. That was a wonderful. He did an absolute great job, but luckily nothing like that happened to me.
Hairy incidents. You relate when you were at Hawker Siddeley, you had the rare opportunity to fly Howard Hughes in a HS-748 when he visited the UK in the 1970s. And he hadn't flown for quite a while, but wanted to take control. So tell us about that.
Well, that was amazing, of course. I think the everyone called it Mission Impossible because he was a great one for seekers, you know. And I was the project pilot of the 146 when it started. And originally, before it was stopped, I was going down to Hatfield to take over there. They didn't have a launch customer for the 146. And Howard Hughes at the time owned Hughes Air West. And so when he wanted to fly, I regarded this as a great marketing opportunity. But of course, when he wanted to fly, it wasn't like an airline departure. He apparently could never make up his mind, but eventually did turn up and fly. And I flew him a couple of times in the 748. And you better read my book, my autobiography about that, because it's quite a story. And then he went on to fly the 125. And he really knew where the ground was. There's no question about that. The only problem was that he always wanted to land on the first inch of the runway. All he wanted to do was circuits and bumps, and he said to me, "You're not the first guy who criticised my landings," it was all. I say I wrote it all up. It was a great marketing opportunity, but unfortunately, he broke his hip, and then there was the fuel. There was that fuel cut off, he left and went away, but of course. In The Aviator, DiCaprio justified the way he played Hughes, but all I can tell you is that when I flew with him, he was just I thought at the time, an old man. I realize now he was a youngster, but he was very courteous, very polite, and he was a splendid chap. He was said to be deaf, but we talked about the 146 in the 125 cabin after the flight. And in fact, I took him all around the 146 mock-up, and he was absolutely completely normal. Great chap, very courteous.
Amazing. From that sort of anecdote, and also from your fiction, it seems that marketing and selling aircraft in those days was a pretty cutthroat business. Do you think that has changed now, or has safety triumphed?
Well, of course, who knows how things go. As a human nature doesn't change. The problem is, of course, that it doesn't take much money for people to alter what they do. And, of course, the sums of money are absolutely advanced. And, of course, it's all a matter of degree. In one of my books, I describe what used to happen in the aircraft competitions, no holds barred. And now, of course, it's done much more in a much more sophisticated manner. But in the end, of course, there'll always be competition.
Definitely, yeah. On the next one, your book on Nimrod, you're more known for some test flying Nimrod. Nimrod Rise and Fall charts the story behind the UK's submarine hunter. Are you optimistic that the UK will regain this capability? And what aircraft type would you pick to be the new MPA if you were in power?
Well, we need it, but I'm not sure we can afford it. The system in the MRA-4, which was cancelled, it had a Boeing system which was working perfectly. It was a great system, and of course it was cancelled, but Boeing have the system on their P-8, and I think the Australians and I think the Indians have bought the P-8 or are buying it, and that's the obvious aircraft, in my view, for the UK to buy, but whether we can afford it, I have no idea.
Okay. At Smith's, you were at Smith's Industries, and you helped develop kind of flight management systems and advanced avionics. What do you think about sort of today's generation of pilots? Are they now too trusting of the glass cockpit and the computers?
I don't know. I don't think I can really comment on that because it's a different world now. The way with the electronic flight bags and everything, I think the people who fly now are very different from the way we used to fly. And quite honestly, I don't feel I can comment.
Okay. As well as the sort of non-fiction books you've written telling the story of the V-bomber's crews and Nimrod, you've also put your vast experience into writing aviation thrillers. So what sort of research goes into these?
Well, I decided I would have an insurance investigator chap called Peter Talbot, and he figures in all the books. And obviously I wrote it based on the experience I'd had of electronics. It's very difficult to write a credible fiction book because aircraft are so safe. It's very hard. And my last two have gone towards military, have a military connotation because I couldn't. Because I say that's because the civil ones are so good, so incredibly safe. But obviously, I like to think that the civil ones I did write are technically accurate. And so I have this chap, Peter Talbot, who gets involved in them all. And my latest one, as I said, is involved with UAV. And it actually is... one of the problems I had, of course, with my... with my books, is that all about aircraft accidents, and so you can't very well sell them at the airports. And of course, I started writing so late that I wasn't able, I had to self-publish. But what I do now is I put all my books, make them all e-books, and. So if anybody, you can go to Kindle or Amazon anywhere and you can download my books or my website. You can't download my books. You can have hard copies off my website, but there's links on my website for the e-books. And they, I don't sell a lot, but I sell quite a few. But I like to think they're all credible stories.
Tony, how many books have you actually authored?
Well, I've done 7 fiction and I've done 6, I think, non-fiction. It's quite difficult on the fiction one with the same guy. You've got to be very careful that you keep track of his life. I keep track of his life story because unfortunately I married him off at the end, so that made it even harder.
So what book are you working on at the moment? What's the next fiction or non-fiction book?
Well, I have to admit I'm not actually at the moment. I'm just I'm pausing at the moment. I'm writing software at the moment, which is much harder.
Writing software. Wow.
I'm trying to write apps. It's very difficult. I find it very difficult at my age, but still.
That's pretty impressive.
Gosh. Yeah, I'm not. I don't have time to write apps. Goodness me. Goodness me. Tony, I just wanted to take you back to the Empire Test Pilot School and find out what it was like back then when you were flying as a test pilot. You talk of meeting some of the great test pilots, but you also talk of being there at a time when the British aviation aviation industry and the manufacturing base was just about to turn. What was it like?
Yes, of course, because all the chief test pilots at that time didn't have the advantage, because they were during the war, so they didn't have the academic training, which all test pilots have now. I was probably one of the first that went through the test pilot school, who had a degree. The other, of course, we all admired very much the guys. I think we all admired all the people. I'm thinking of all the names now who came to talk. And then, of course, we used to...
Neville Duke,
Roly Falk, of course, who employed me, and all these they all came, and Brian Trubshaw, they all came and briefed us on what they were doing, which was always very interesting. Then, of course, there was the hard work on the course, having to learn. We had an awful lot to learn, and it kept us quite busy. I think nowadays, I think they're almost degree courses. If they're not degree courses, they're much higher technically than they were when we were there. But there was still a great technical need. And of course, the other thing I should have said was that the revolution that took place as I went through my career was that originally all these chief test pilots at the time, there was not much instrumentation, so everybody had to listen very carefully to what the chief test pilot said and respond. Whereas gradually you had teamwork developing, and instead of just a chief test pilot, you then had more and more technicians, you had instrumentation on the aircraft, and it became much more of teamwork. And it had to be, of course, to be economically successful. Of course, that's the thing I would have said, the thing you have to remember of a firm's pilot is the firm has got to be relies on the aircraft being successful, and so you must make an aircraft just good enough. It's no good. When I started, we used to put bells and whistles on it, but certainly on the military stuff, but on the civil, you just have to meet the regulations, no more. And if the regulations are a bit lax, well, that's the way it is. You don't get any money for making the aircraft better than the regulations. And of course, it isn't just the regulations. You've got to meet the performance targets as well.
Interesting.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
But Tony, I'd just like to your career has kind of sort of spanned the kind, from the sort of 50s to the sort of 70s and beyond, and they, I wonder what your thoughts are on the post-war British aviation industry. As perhaps you've read James Hamilton Patterson's Empire of the Clouds. Do you subscribe to his view of kind of the decline or the squandering of the by politicians, the short-sightedness?
I don't know whether to blame the politicians, but there's no doubt that unfortunately we gradually lost our lead. I suppose one of the reasons was you have to have a very big team, very expensive. Coming back to Rolls-Royce again, it really is remarkable that they are able to do what they can do. But I suppose in developing an airplane, a successful commercial airplane, is even more demanding, more expensive. And we just couldn't do it by ourselves. And it's a great shame. You obviously saw that you saw that TV series, was it when Britain Ruled the World or something?
That's right, yeah.
And it's so different now. Of course, it's very sad, but we're now down really to two large manufacturers. Obviously, there are lots of other ones, but we just went. I'm not sure. I would join in blaming the politicians. I think the way technology has developed.
Yeah.
Has a large part to play.
Okay. Finally, Tony, where can we find your fiction and your non-fiction books online and find you on Twitter?
Well, I don't know about where you find me on Twitter. I never remember. I'm not an aggro. I go on it once or twice, but I certainly can't remember. But my non-fiction, my fiction books, you can just go to to Kindle and just put my name in and the books will all appear, or you can go onto my website and read what you're going to buy, and then you can, there's a link from each of my books to, I think they're Kindle at the moment, and people can buy them like that. On the non-fiction, of course, it's they're advertised in the normal way, and but again, most of, I think some of my fiction, my non-fiction are now online. I think my latest two, probably you've still got to have hardbacks.
Yeah. Okay.
I'll put links to those for you, Tony, in the show notes so that people can go directly to get those. Tony, I just wanted to jump in before Tim wraps up there and talk. How many aircraft types have you actually flown?
I haven't flown very many. I think I've flown 60. I mean,
That is a
no,
lot.
It's not like Winkle. No. I've only flown.
No.
As a firm's test pilot, you don't get once you join a firm, you don't get much chance to fly different types of aircraft. I think we were incredibly lucky at Avro's to think all the aircraft we had. I mean, we used Valiants for dropping blue steel. And of course, when Handley Page stopped operating, we did the Victor Mark II development, which was a fantastic job. Victor Mark II was a splendid tanker, and we did that. And of course, we had the Nimrod, and then we had the 748. So we had we were very lucky to have all those different types of aircraft in that short period of time.
And am I right in thinking that you test flew the first Vulcan Mark II, which of course was XH-558, which is in its final year, we think?
I didn't do the initial on the Mark II. The initial Mark IIs were done by Jimmy Harrison, started on the prototype VX-777. But I did, obviously, 558 was the first, I say obviously, it was the first production Mark II, and unusually, the RAF crews always used to come and collect it. But this particular one, 5-8, being the first Mark II, and they hadn't flown it, I actually had to deliver it. It was a remarkable coincidence. I regard it as my baby when I see it flying now. since I flew it.
Yeah.
1st of July 1960, I delivered it to RAF Waddington. So a year or two ago.
Wow. We're going to come back to that a little later, but one final question, Tim, if I may, just before you wrap up. I did read somewhere that you had some interesting views on helicopters in your test flying days.
I don't know about interesting. We were the first course that had helicopters, and I reckoned that being a helicopter test pilot was a really dangerous job. And I certainly had the feeling that if you upset the I can't remember his name, if you upset the chap in charge of the test pilot school, you were liable to get posted to D squadron. So I wasn't very good at flying helicopters. I regret it now. I wish I had learned to fly helicopters because I had the opportunity, but I certainly deliberately wasn't very good on the course because I didn't want to be posted to D squadron.
And you also got to fly a B-52 as well. What was that like?
Well, I'm prouder of flying the B-47 actually because
oh wow!
I don't know whether you remember, but there was a Skybolt, this air launched ballistic missile,
definitely. Yeah,
which the Vulcan was going to carry, and in fact it did carry. We did lots of drops, did a lot of flying with it. I did all the flying on that, and but they wanted to do some radio trials, and the radio trials had to be done on the West Coast. And so I volunteered to deliver the aircraft out, to deliver a Vulcan out to Edwards. And they did their trials, and then I brought it back again. And, of course, while it was there, we had to do air tests and things. And I did a swap so that I flew the B-52 and one of the other guys flew the Vulcan. And the same on the B-47.
Wow.
The B-47 was a fantastic aircraft. With this wonderful canopy, you felt you could see the whole of California. If you compare the view out of the V-bombers and that out of a B-47, the contrast is absolutely amazing. The B-52, from a view point of view, was just more like the V-bombers. And it was an interesting aircraft.
Fantastic. Kind of reminds me also, as you're saying about the sort of Skybolt and the Vulcan, some of the kind of odd concepts for. I think I've seen a concept for a Vulcan where it would be a kind of interim air defense type with like long range missiles. It'd be kind of a weapon, you know, a missile truck to fire long range missiles. And also, I think there was a one. Isn't there one where there was some kind of idea as having parasite fighters in the form of gnats slung under the wings?
I don't remember that. I think that the Skybolt was really the only thing. And of course, one of the great advantages of the Skybolt, even though the project was cancelled, was that all the wings had to be strengthened to carry the Skybolt. And so when the deterrent went low level, the Vulcan was able to do that because it then had a very good fatigue life.
Ah, right.
Unlike the Victor. The Victor, of course, was absolutely superb as a tank, as I said earlier, but it wasn't able to do the low-level flying, which the Vulcan was able to do.
Tony, it's been absolutely fantastic to speak to you now.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Did you know that the first G-suit for British pilots was essentially a chest-high pair of fisherman's waders which were filled with 2 gallons of water? The water automatically squeezed the pilot's legs as positive G was applied. Did you also know that the Islamic Republic of Iran Air Force's oldest McDonnell Douglas F-4D Phantom is set to clock up more than 70 years in service, having been delivered in 1968 and now subject to life extension programs taking it to 2040? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com. and see what you're missing.
We'd like to thank White Hearts, as well as the wider extended family of supporters, including The Aviation Historian. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find Tim Garofanelli on the extended Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram feeds. And that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our program and broaden its reach. You can also review the program and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Extended!
This is XTP Media.